Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 10. 2. To facilitate the acceptance of force, the Berkeley rebels attempted to establish a special distinction between force and violence. Force, they claimed explicitly, is a proper form of social action, but violence is not. Their definition of the terms was as follows. Coercion, by means of a literal physical contact, is violence and is reprehensible. Any other way of violating rights is merely force and is a legitimate, peaceful method of dealing with opponents. For instance, if the rebels occupy the administration building, that is force. If policemen drag them out, that is violence. If Savio grabs a microphone he has no right to use, that is force. If a policeman drags him away from it, that is violence. Consider the implications of that distinction as a rule of social conduct. If you come home one evening, find a stranger occupying your house, and throw him out bodily, he has merely committed a peaceful act of force, but you are guilty of violence, and you are to be punished. The theoretical purpose of that grotesque absurdity is to establish a moral inversion, to make the initiation of force moral, and resistance to force immoral, and thus to obliterate the right of self-defense. The immediate, practical purpose is to foster the activities of the lowest political breed, the provocateurs, who commit acts of force and place the blame on their victims. 3. To justify that fraudulent distinction, the Berkeley rebels attempted to obliterate a legitimate one, the distinction between ideas and actions. They claimed that freedom of speech means freedom of action, and that no clear line of demarcation can be drawn between them. For instance, if they have the right to advocate any political viewpoint, they claimed, they have the right to organize on campus any off-campus activities, even those forbidden by law. As Professor Peterson put it, they were claiming the right to use the university as a sanctuary from which to make illegal raids on the general community. The difference between an exchange of ideas and an exchange of blows is self-evident. The line of demarcation between freedom of speech and freedom of action is established by the ban on the initiation of physical force. It is only when that ban is abrogated that such a problem can arise. But when that ban is abrogated, no political freedom of any kind can remain in existence. At a superficial glance, the rebels' package deal may seem to imply a sort of anarchistic extension of freedom, but in fact and in logic, it implies the exact opposite, which is a grim joke on those unthinking youths who joined the rebellion in the name of free speech. If the freedom to express ideas were equated with the freedom to commit crimes, it would not take long to demonstrate that no organized society can exist on such terms, and therefore that the expression of ideas has to be curtailed, and some ideas have to be forbidden, just as criminal acts are forbidden. Thus the gullible would be brought to concede that the right of free speech is undefinable and impracticable. 4. An indication of such a motive was given by the rebels' demand for unrestricted freedom of speech on campus, with the consequent filthy language movement. There can be no such thing as the right to an unrestricted freedom of speech or of action on someone else's property. The fact that the university at Berkeley is owned by the state merely complicates the issue, but does not alter it. The owners of a state university are the voters and taxpayers of that state. The university administration, appointed directly or indirectly by an elected official, is theoretically the agent of the owners and has to act as such, so long as state universities exist. Whether they should exist is a different question. In any undertaking or establishment involving more than one man, it is the owner or owners who set the rules and terms of appropriate conduct. The rest of the participants are free to go elsewhere and seek different terms if they do not agree. There can be no such thing as the right to act on whim, to be exercised by some participants at the expense of others. Students who attend a university have the right to expect that they will not be subjected to hearing the kind of obscenities for which the owner of a semi-decent bar room would bounce hoodlums out on the street. The right to determine what sort of language is permissible belongs to the administration of a university, fully as much as to the owner of a bar room. The technique of the rebels, as of all statists, was to take advantage of the principles of a free society in order to undercut them by an alleged demonstration of their impracticability, in this case the impracticability of the right of free speech. But in fact what they have demonstrated is a point farthest removed from their goals, that no rights of any kind can be exercised without property rights. It is only on the basis of property rights that the sphere and application of individual rights can be defined in any given social situation. Without property rights, there is no way to solve or to avoid a hopeless chaos of clashing views, interests, demands, desires, and whims. There is no way for the Berkeley administration to answer the rebels except by invoking property rights. It is obvious why neither modern liberals nor conservatives would care to do so. It is not the contradictions of a free society that the rebels were exposing and cashing in on, but the contradictions of a mixed economy. As to the question of what ideological policy should properly be adopted by the administration of a state university, it is a question that has no answer. There are no solutions for the many contradictions inherent in the concept of public property, particularly when the property is directly concerned with the dissemination of ideas. This is one of the reasons why the rebels would choose a state university as their first battleground. A good case could be made for the claim that a state university has no right to forbid the teaching or advocacy of any political viewpoint whatever, as for instance of communism, since some of the tax-paying owners may be communists. An equally good case could be made for the claim that a state university has no right to permit the teaching and advocacy of any political viewpoint which, as for instance communism, is a direct threat to the property, freedom, and lives of the majority of the tax-paying owners. Majority rule is not applicable in the realm of ideas. An individual's convictions are not subject to a majority vote. But neither an individual, nor a minority, nor a majority should be forced to support their own destroyers. On the one hand, a government institution has no right to forbid the expression of any ideas. On the other hand, a government institution has no right to harbor, assist, and finance the country's enemies, as for instance the collectors of funds for the Viet Cong. The source of these contradictions does not lie in the principle of individual rights, but in their violation of the collectivist institution of public property. This issue, however, has to be fought in the field of constitutional law, not on campus. As students, the rebels have no greater rights in a state university than in a private one. As taxpayers, they have no greater rights than the millions of other California taxpayers involved. If they object to the policies of the Board of Regents, they have no recourse except at the polls at the next election, if they can persuade a sufficient number of voters. This is a pretty slim chance, and this is a good argument against any type of public property. But it is not an issue to be solved by physical force. What is significant here is the fact that the rebels, who, to put it mildly, are not champions of private property, refuse to abide by the kind of majority rule which is inherent in public ownership. That is what they were opposing when they complained that universities have become servants of the financial, industrial, and military establishment. It is the rights of these particular groups of taxpayers, the right to a voice in the management of state universities, that they were seeking to abrogate. If anyone needs proof of the fact that the advocates of public ownership are not seeking democratic control of property by majority rule, but control by dictatorship, this is one eloquent piece of evidence. 5. As part of the ideological conditioning for that ultimate goal, the rebels attempted to introduce a new variant on an old theme that has been the object of an intense drive by all statist collectivists for many years past. The obliteration of the difference between private action and government action. This has always been attempted by means of a package deal ascribing to private citizens the specific violations constitutionally forbidden to the government, and thus destroying individual rights while freeing the government from any restrictions. The most frequent example of this technique consists of accusing private citizens of practicing censorship, a concept applicable only to the government, and thus negating their right to disagree. The new variant provided by the rebels was their protest against alleged double jeopardy. It went as follows. If the students commit illegal acts, they will be punished by the courts and must not therefore be penalized by the university for the same offense. Double jeopardy is a concept applicable only to the government and only to one branch of the government, the judiciary, and only to a specific judiciary action. It means that a man must not be put on trial twice for the same offense. To equate private judgment and action, or in this context a government official's judgment and action, with a court trial is worse than absurd. It is an outrageous attempt to obliterate the right to moral judgment and moral action. It is a demand that a lawbreaker suffer no civil consequences of his crime. If such a notion were accepted, individuals would have no right to evaluate the conduct of others, nor to act according to their evaluation. They would have to wait until a court had declared whether a given man was guilty or innocent, and even after he was pronounced guilty, they would have no right to change their behavior toward him, and would have to leave the task of penalizing him exclusively to the government. For instance, if a bank employee were found guilty of embezzlement and had served his sentence, the bank would have no right to refuse to give him back his former job, since a refusal would constitute double jeopardy. Or, a government official would have no right to watch the legality of the actions of his department's employees, nor to lay down rules for their strict observance of the law, but would have to wait until a court had found them guilty of lawbreaking and would have to reinstate them in their jobs after they had served their sentences for influence peddling or bribe-taking or treason. The notion of morality as a monopoly of the government and of a single branch or group within the government is so blatantly a part of the ideology of a dictatorship that the rebels' attempt to get away with it is truly shocking. 6. The rebels' notion that universities should be run by students and faculties was an open, explicit assault on the right attacked implicitly by all their other notions, the right of private property, and of all the various statist collectivist systems, the one they chose as their goal is politico-economically the least practical, intellectually the least defensible, morally the most shameful. Guild socialism. Guild socialism is a system that abolishes the exercise of individual ability by chaining men into groups according to their line of work, and delivering the work into the group's power as its exclusive domain, with the group dictating the rules, standards, and practices of how the work is to be done, and who shall or shall not do it. Guild socialism is the concrete-bound, routine-bound mentality of a savage elevated into a social theory. Just as a tribe of savages seizes a piece of jungle territory and claims it as a monopoly by reason of the fact of being there, so guild socialism grants a monopoly not on a jungle forest or waterhole, but on a factory or a university. Not by reason of a man's ability, achievement, or even public service, but by reason of the fact that he is there. Just as savages have no concept of causes or consequences, of past or future, and no concept of efficacy beyond the muscular power of their tribe, so guild socialists, finding themselves in the midst of an industrial civilization, regard its institutions as phenomena of nature, and see no reason why the gang should not seize them. If there is any one proof of a man's incompetence, it is the stagnant mentality of a worker or of a professor who, doing some small routine job in a vast undertaking, does not care to look beyond the lever of a machine or the lectern of a classroom, does not choose to know how the machine or the classroom got there or what makes his job possible, and proclaims that the management of the undertaking is parasitical and unnecessary. Managerial work, the organization and integration of human effort into purposeful, large-scale, long-range activities, is in the realm of action what man's conceptual faculty is in the realm of cognition. It is beyond the grasp and therefore is the first target of the self-arrested sensory-perceptual mentality. If there is any one way to confess one's own mediocrity, it is the willingness to place one's work in the absolute power of a group, particularly a group of one's professional colleagues. Of any forms of tyranny, this is the worst. It is directed against a single human attribute, the mind, and against a single enemy, the innovator. The innovator, by definition, is the man who challenges the established practices of his profession. To grant a professional monopoly to any group is to sacrifice human ability and abolish progress. To advocate such a monopoly is to confess that one has nothing to sacrifice. Guild socialism is the rule of, by, and for mediocrity. Its cause is a society's intellectual collapse. Its consequence is a quagmire of stagnation. Its historical example is the guild system of the Middle Ages, or in modern times, the fascist system of Italy under Mussolini. The rebels' notion that students, along with faculties, should run universities and determine their curricula is a crude absurdity. If an ignorant youth comes to an institution of learning in order to acquire knowledge of a certain science, by what means is he to determine what is relevant and how he should be taught? In the process of learning, he can judge only whether his teacher's presentation is clear or unclear, logical or contradictory. He cannot determine the proper course and method of teaching ahead of any knowledge of the subject. It is obvious that a student who demands the right to run a university, or to decide who should run it, has no knowledge of the concept of knowledge, that his demand is self-contradictory and disqualifies him automatically. The same is true, with a much heavier burden of moral guilt, of the professor who taught him to make such demands and who supports them. Would you care to be treated in a hospital where the methods of therapy were determined by a vote of doctors and patients? Yet the absurdity of these examples is merely more obvious, not more irrational or more vicious, than the standard collectivist claim that workers should take over the factories created by men whose achievement they can neither grasp nor equal. The basic epistemological moral premise and pattern are the same. The obliteration of reason obliterates the concept of reality, which obliterates the concept of achievement, which obliterates the concept of the distinction between the earned and the unearned. Then the incompetent can seize factories, the ignorant can seize universities, the brutes can seize scientific research laboratories, and nothing is left in a human society but the power of whim and fist. What makes guild socialism cruder than, but not different from, most statist collectivist theories is the fact that it represents the other, the usually unmentioned side of altruism. It is the voice not of the givers but of the receivers. While most altruistic theorists proclaim the common good as their justification, advocate self-sacrificial service to the community, and keep silent about the exact nature or identity of the recipients of sacrifices, guild socialists brazenly declare themselves to be the recipients and present their claims to the community, demanding its services. If they want a monopoly on a given profession, they claim, the rest of the community must give up the right to practice it. If they want a university, they claim, the community must provide it. And if selfishness is taken by the altruists to mean the sacrifice of others to self, I challenge them to name an uglier example of it than the pronouncement of the little Berkeley collectivist who declared, our idea is that the university is composed of faculty, students, books, and ideas. In a literal sense, the administration is merely there to make sure the sidewalks are kept clean. It should be the servant of the faculty and the students. What did that little disembodied mystic omit from his idea of a university? Who pays the salaries of the faculty? Who provides the livelihood of the students? Who publishes the books? Who builds the classrooms, the libraries, the dormitories, and the sidewalks? Leave it to a modern mystic of muscle to display the kind of contempt for vulgar material concerns that an old-fashioned mystic would not quite dare permit himself. Who, besides the university administration, is to be the voiceless, rightless servant and sidewalk sweeper of the faculty and students? No, not only the men of productive genius who create the material wealth that makes universities possible. Not only the tycoons of business, not only the financial, industrial, and military establishment, but every taxpayer of the state of California, every man who works for a living, high or low, every human being who earns his sustenance, struggles with his budget, pays for what he gets, and does not permit himself to evade the reality of vulgar material concerns. Such is the soul revealed by the ideology of the Berkeley Rebellion. Such is the meaning of the rebels' demands and of the ideological precedents they were trying to establish. Observe the complexity, the equivocations, the tricks, the twists, the intellectual acrobatics performed by these avowed advocates of unbridled feelings, and the ideological consistency of these activists who claim to possess no ideology. The first round of the student rebellion has not gone over too well. In spite of the gratuitous puff job done by the press, the attitude of the public is a mixture of bewilderment, indifference, and antagonism. Indifference because the evasive vagueness of the press reports was self-defeating. People do not understand what it is all about and see no reason to care. Antagonism because the American public still holds a profound respect for universities, as they might be and ought to be, but are not any longer, and the commentators' half-laudatory, half-humorous platitudes about the idealism of youth have not succeeded in whitewashing the fact that brute physical force was brought to a university campus. That fact has aroused a vague sense of uneasiness in people, a sense of undefined, apprehensive condemnation. The rebellion's attempt to invade other campuses did not get very far. There were some disgraceful proclamations of appeasement by some university administrators and commencement orators this spring, but no discernible public sympathy. There were a few instances of a proper attitude on the part of university administrations, an attitude of firmness, dignity, and uncompromising severity, notably at Columbia University. A commencement address by Dr. Meng, president of Hunter College, is also worth noting. Declaring that the violation of the rights of others is intolerable in an academic community, and that any student or teacher guilty of it deserves instant expulsion, he said. Yesterday's ivory tower has become today's foxhole. The leisure of the theory class is increasingly occupied in the organization of picket lines, teach-ins, think-ins, and stakeouts of one sort or another. But even though the student rebellion has not aroused much public sympathy, the most ominous aspect of the situation is the fact that it has not met any ideological opposition, that the implications of the rebels' stand have neither been answered nor rejected, that such criticism as it did evoke was, with rare exceptions, evasively superficial. As a trial balloon, the rebellion has accomplished its leaders' purpose. It has demonstrated that they may have gone a bit too far, bared their teeth and claws a bit too soon, and antagonized many potential sympathizers, even among the liberals, but that the road ahead is empty, with no intellectual barricades in sight. The battle is to continue. The long-range intentions of the student rebellion have been proclaimed repeatedly by the same activists who proclaim their exclusive dedication to the immediate moment. The remnants of the free speech movement at Berkeley have been reorganized into a free student union, which is making militant noises in preparation for another assault. No matter how absurd their notions, the rebels' assaults are directed at the most important philosophical-political issues of our age. These issues cannot be ignored, evaded, or bribed away by compromise. When brute force is on the march, compromise is the red carpet. When reason is attacked, common sense is not enough. Neither a man nor a nation can exist without some form of philosophy. A man has the free will to think or not. If he does not, he takes what he gets. The free will of a nation is its intellectuals. The rest of the country takes what they offer. They set the terms, the values, the course, the goal. In the absence of intellectual opposition, the rebels' notions will gradually come to be absorbed into the culture. The uncontested absurdities of today are the accepted slogans of tomorrow. They come to be accepted by degrees, by precedent, by implication, by erosion, by default, by dint of constant pressure on one side and constant retreat on the other, until the day when they are suddenly declared to be the country's official ideology. That is the way welfare statism came to be accepted in this country. What we are witnessing today is an acceleration of the attempts to cash in on the ideological implications of welfare statism and to push beyond it. The college rebels are merely the commandos charged with the task of establishing ideological beachheads for a full-scale advance of all the statist collectivist forces against the remnants of capitalism in America, and part of their task is the takeover of the ideological control of America's universities. If the collectivists succeed, the terrible historical irony will lie in the fact that what looks like a noisy, reckless, belligerent confidence is in fact a hysterical bluff. The acceleration of collectivism's advance is not the march of winners, but the blind stampede of losers. Collectivism has lost the battle for men's minds. Its advocates know it. Their last chance consists of the fact that no one else knows it. If they are to cash in on decades of philosophical corruption, on all the gnawing, scrapping, scratching, burrowing to dig a maze of philosophical rat holes which is about to cave in, it's now or never. As a cultural intellectual power and a moral ideal, collectivism died in World War II. If we are still rolling in its direction, it is only by the inertia of a void and the momentum of disintegration. A social movement that began with the ponderous, brain-cracking dialectical constructs of Hegel and Marx and ends up with a horde of morally unwashed children stamping their foot and shrieking, "I want it now," is through. All over the world, while mowing down one helpless nation after another, collectivism has been steadily losing the two elements that hold the key to the future, the brains of mankind and its youth. In regard to the first, observe Britain's brain drain. In regard to the second, consider the fact, which was not mentioned in the press comments on the student rebellion, that in a predominant number of American universities, the political views of the faculty are perceptibly more liberal than those of the student body. The same is true of the youth of the country at large, as against the older generation, the 35 to 50 age bracket, who were reared under the New Deal and who hold the country's leadership at present. That is one of the facts which the student rebellion was intended to disguise. This is not to say that the anti-collectivists represent a numerical majority among college students. The passive supporters of the status quo are always the majority in any group, culture, society, or age. But it is not by passive majorities that the trends of a nation are set. Who sets them? Anyone who cares to do so, if he has the intellectual ammunition to win on the battlefield of ideas, which belongs to those who do care. Those who don't are merely social ballast by their own choice and predilection. The fact that the non-liberals among college students and among the youth of the world can be identified at present only as anti-collectivists is the dangerous element and the question mark in today's situation. They are the young people who are not ready to give up, who want to fight against a swamp of evil, but do not know what is the good. They have rejected the sick, worn platitudes of collectivism, along with all of its cultural manifestations, including the cult of despair and depravity, the studied mindlessness of jerk-and-moan dancing, singing, or acting, the worship of anti-heroes, the experience of looking up to the dissection of a psychotic's brain for inspiration, and to the bare feet of an inarticulate brute for guidance, the stupor of reduction to sensory stimuli, the sense of life of a movie such as Tom Jones. But they have found as yet no direction, no consistent philosophy, no rational views, no long-range goals. Until and unless they do, their incoherent striving for a better future will collapse before the final thrust of the collectivists. Historically, we are now in a kind of intellectual no-man's land, and the future will be determined by those who venture out of the trenches of the status quo. Our direction will depend on whether the venturers are crusaders fighting for a new renaissance, or scavengers pouncing upon the wreckage left of yesterday's battles. The crusaders are not yet ready. The scavengers are. That is why, in a deeper sense than the little zombies of college campuses will ever grasp, now is the last slogan and cry of the ragged, bearded stragglers who had once been an army rallied by the promise of a scientifically planned society. The two most accurate characterizations of the student rebellion given in the press were political existentialism and Castroite. Both are concepts pertaining to intellectual bankruptcy. The first stands for the abdication of reason, the second for that state of hysterical panic which brandishes a fist as its sole recourse. In preparation for its published survey, March 22, 1965, Newsweek conducted a number of polls among college students at large on various subjects, one of which was the question of who are the students' heroes. The editors of Newsweek informed me that my name appeared on the resultant list and sent an interviewer to question me about my views on the state of modern universities. For reasons best known to themselves, they chose not to publish any part of that interview. What I said in briefer form was what I am now saying in this article, with the exception of the concluding remarks which follow, and which I want to address most particularly to those college students who chose me as one of their heroes. Young people are constantly asking what they can do to fight today's disastrous trends. They are seeking some form of action and wrecking their hopes in blind alleys, particularly every 4 years at election time. Those who do not realize that the battle is ideological had better give up, because they have no chance. Those who do realize it should grasp that the student rebellion offers them a chance to train themselves for the kind of battle they will have to fight in the world when they leave the university. A chance not only to train themselves, but to win the first rounds of that wider battle. If they seek an important cause, they have the opportunity to fight the rebels, to fight ideologically on moral intellectual grounds, by identifying and exposing the meaning of the rebels' demands, by naming and answering the basic principles which the rebels dare not admit. The battle consists above all of providing the country, or all those within hearing, with ideological answers, a field of action from which the older generation has deserted under fire. Ideas cannot be fought except by means of better ideas. The battle consists not of opposing but of exposing, not of denouncing but of disproving, not of evading but of boldly proclaiming a full, consistent, and radical alternative. This does not mean that rational students should enter debates with the rebels or attempt to convert them. One cannot argue with self-confessed irrationalists. The goal of an ideological battle is to enlighten the vast, helpless, bewildered majority in the universities, in the country at large, or rather, the minds of those among the majority who are struggling to find answers, or those who, having heard nothing but collectivist sophistries for years, have withdrawn in revulsion and given up. The first goal of such a battle is to wrest from a handful of beatniks the title of spokesman for American youth, which the press is so anxious to grant them. The first step is to make oneself heard, on the campus and outside. There are many civilized ways to do it. Protest meetings, public petitions, speeches, pamphlets, letters to editors. It is a much more important issue than picketing the United Nations or parading in support of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And while such futile groups as Young Americans for Freedom are engaged in such undertakings, they are letting the collectivist vanguard speak in their name, in the name of American college students, without any audible sound of protest. But in order to be heard, one must have something to say. To have that, one must know one's case. One must know it fully, logically, consistently, all the way down to philosophical fundamentals. One cannot hope to fight nuclear experts with Republican pea shooters, and the leaders behind the student rebellion are experts at their particular game. But they are dangerous only to those who stare at the issues out of focus and hope to fight ideas by means of faith, feelings, and fundraising. You would be surprised how quickly the ideologists of collectivism retreat when they encounter a confident intellectual adversary. Their case rests on appealing to human confusion, ignorance, dishonesty, cowardice, despair. Take the side they dare not approach. Appeal to human intelligence. Collectivism has lost the two crucial weapons that raised it to world power and made all of its victories possible, intellectuality and idealism, or reason and morality. It had to lose them precisely at the height of its success, since its claim to both was a fraud. The full actual reality of socialist, communist, fascist states has demonstrated the brute irrationality of collectivist systems and the inhumanity of altruism as a moral code. Yet reason and morality are the only weapons that determine the course of history. The collectivists dropped them because they had no right to carry them. Pick them up. You have. Chapter 23, Alienation, by Nathaniel Brandon. And how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's, I a stranger and afraid in a world I never made? In the writings of contemporary psychologists and sociologists, one encounters these lines from A.E. Housman's poem more and more often today, quoted as an eloquent summation of the sense of life and psychological plight of 20th century man. In book after book of social commentary, one finds the same message. Modern man is overwhelmed by anxiety. Modern man suffers from an identity crisis. Modern man is alienated. Who am I? Where am I going? Do I belong? These are the crucial questions man asks himself in modern mass society, declares the sociologist and psychoanalyst Heinrich M. Reutenbeek in The Individual and the Crowd, A Study of Identity in America. The concept of alienation, in its original psychiatric usage, denoted the mentally ill, the severely mentally ill, often particularly in legal contexts, the insane. It conveyed the notion of the breakdown of rationality and self-determination, the notion of a person driven by forces which he cannot grasp or control, which are experienced by him as compelling and alien, so that he feels estranged from himself. Centuries earlier, medieval theologians had spoken with distress of man's alienation from God, of an overconcern with the world of the senses that caused man to become lost to himself, estranged from his proper spiritual estate. It was the philosopher Hegel who introduced the concept of alienation, outside of its psychiatric context, to the modern world. The history of man, maintained Hegel, is the history of man's self-alienation. Man is blind to his true essence. He is lost in the dead world of social institutions and of property, which he himself has created. He is estranged from the universal being of which he is a part. And human progress consists of man's motion toward that whole, as he transcends the limitations of his individual perceptions. Alienation was taken over by Karl Marx and given a narrower, less cosmic meaning. He applied the concept primarily to the worker. The worker's alienation was inevitable, he asserted, with the development of the division of labor, specialization, exchange, and private property. The worker must sell his services, thus he comes to view himself as a commodity. He becomes alienated from the product of his own labor, and his work is no longer the expression of his powers, of his inner self. The worker, who is alive, is ruled by that which is dead, i.e. capital, machinery. The consequence, says Marx, is spiritual impoverishment and mutilation. The worker is alienated from himself, from nature, and from his fellow men. He exists only as an animated object, not as a human being. Since the time of Marx, the idea of alienation has been used more and more extensively by psychologists, sociologists, and philosophers, gathering to itself a wide variety of usages and meanings. But from Hegel and Marx onward, there appears to be an almost universal reluctance on the part of those who employ the term to define it precisely. It is as if one were expected to feel its meaning rather than to grasp it conceptually. In a two-volume collection of essays entitled Alienation, the editor Gerald Sykes specifically scorns those who are too eager for a definition of the term. Haste for a definition, he declares, reveals that one suffers from an advanced case of alienation. Certain writers, notably those of a Freudian or Jungian orientation, declare that the complexity of modern industrial society has caused man to become over-civilized, to have lost touch with the deeper roots of his being, to have become alienated from his instinctual nature. Others, notably those of an existentialist or Zen Buddhist orientation, complain that our advanced technological society compels man to live too intellectually, to be ruled by abstractions, thus alienating him from the real world, which can be experienced in its wholeness only via his emotions. Others, especially those of a petulant mediocrity orientation, decry specifically the alienation of the artist. They assert that with the vanishing of the age of patrons, with the artist thrown on his own resources to struggle in the marketplace, which is ruled by Philistines, the artist is condemned to fight a losing battle for the preservation of his spiritual integrity. He is too besieged by material temptations. Most of these writers declare that the problem of alienation and of man's search for identity is not new, but has been a source of anguish to man in every age and culture. But they insist that today in Western civilization, above all in America, the problem has reached an unprecedented severity. It has become a crisis. What is responsible for this crisis? What has alienated man and deprived him of identity? The answer given by most writers on alienation is not always stated explicitly, but in their countless disparaging references to the dehumanizing effects of industrialism, soul-destroying commercialism, the arid rationalism of a technological culture, the vulgar materialism of the West, etc., the villain in their view of things, the destroyer whom they hold chiefly responsible, is not hard to identify. It is capitalism. This should not be startling. Since its birth, capitalism has been made the scapegoat responsible for almost every real or imagined evil denounced by anyone. As the distinguished economist Ludwig von Mises observes, nothing is more unpopular today than the free market economy, i.e. capitalism. Everything that is considered unsatisfactory in present-day conditions is charged to capitalism. The atheists make capitalism responsible for the survival of Christianity, but the papal encyclicals blame capitalism for the spread of irreligion and the sins of our contemporaries, and the Protestant churches and sects are no less vigorous in their indictment of capitalist greed. Friends of peace consider our wars as an offshoot of capitalist imperialism. But the adamant nationalist warmongers of Germany and Italy indicted capitalism for its bourgeois pacifism, contrary to human nature and to the inescapable laws of history. Sermonizers accuse capitalism of disrupting the family and fostering licentiousness. But the progressives blame capitalism for the preservation of allegedly outdated rules of sexual restraint. Almost all men agree that poverty is an outcome of capitalism. On the other hand, many deplore the fact that capitalism, in catering lavishly to the wishes of people intent upon getting more amenities and a better living, promotes a crass materialism. These contradictory accusations of capitalism cancel one another. But the fact remains that there are few people left who would not condemn capitalism altogether. It is true that a great many men suffer from a chronic feeling of inner emptiness, of spiritual impoverishment, the sense of lacking personal identity. It is true that a great many men feel alienated from something, even if they cannot say from what, from themselves or other men or the universe. And it is profoundly significant that capitalism should be blamed for this. Not because there is any justification for the charge, but because by analyzing the reasons given for the accusation, one can learn a good deal about the nature and meaning of men's sense of alienation and non-identity, and simultaneously about the psychological motives that give rise to hostility toward capitalism. The writers on alienation, as I have indicated, are not an intellectually homogeneous group. They differ in many areas, in their view of what the problem of alienation exactly consists of, in the aspects of modern industrial society and a free market economy, which they find most objectionable, in the explicitness with which they identify capitalism as the villain, and in the details of their own political inclinations. Some of these writers are socialists, some are fascists, some are medievalists, some are supporters of the welfare state. Some scorn politics altogether. Some believe that the problem of alienation is largely or entirely solvable by a new system of social organization. Others believe that the problem at bottom is metaphysical and that no entirely satisfactory solution can be found. Fortunately for the purposes of this analysis, however, there is one contemporary writer who manages to combine in his books virtually all of the major errors perpetrated by commentators in this field. Psychologist and sociologist Erich Fromm. Let us therefore consider Fromm's view of man and his theory of alienation in some detail. Man, declares Erich Fromm, is the freak of the universe. This theme is crucial and central throughout his writings. Man is radically different from all other living species. He is estranged and alienated from nature. He is overwhelmed by a feeling of isolation and separateness. He has lost, in the process of evolution, the undisturbed tranquility of other organisms. He has lost the pre-human harmony with nature which is enjoyed by an animal, a bird, or a worm. The source of his curse is the fact that he possesses a mind. Self-awareness, reason, and imagination, Fromm writes in Man for Himself, have disrupted the harmony which characterizes animal existence. Their emergence has made man into an anomaly, into the freak of the universe. Man cannot live as an animal. He is not equipped to adapt himself automatically and unthinkingly to his environment. An animal blindly repeats the pattern of the species. Its behavior is biologically prescribed and stereotyped. It either fits in or it dies out. But it does not have to solve the problem of survival. It is not conscious of life and death as an issue. Man does and is. This is his tragedy. Reason, man's blessing, is also his curse. In The Art of Loving, he writes, "What is essential in the existence of man is the fact that he has emerged from the animal kingdom, from instinctive adaptation, that he has transcended nature. Although he never leaves it, he is part of it, and yet once torn away from nature, he cannot return to it. Once thrown out of paradise, a state of original oneness with nature, cherubim with flaming swords block his way if he should try to return." That man's rational faculty deprives man of paradise, alienating and estranging him from nature, is clearly revealed, says Fromm, in the existential dichotomies which his mind dooms man to confront, contradictions inherent in life itself. What are these tragic dichotomies? He names three as central and basic. Man's mind permits him to visualize his own end, death, yet his body makes him want to be alive. Man's nature contains innumerable potentialities, yet the short span of his life does not permit their full realization under even the most favorable circumstances. Man must be alone when he has to judge or to make decisions solely by the power of his reason, yet he cannot bear to be alone, to be unrelated to his fellow men. These contradictions, says Fromm, constitute the dilemma of the human situation, contradictions with which man is compelled to struggle, but which he can never resolve or annul, and which alienate man from himself, from his fellow men, and from nature. If the logic of the foregoing is not readily perceivable, the reason does not lie in the brevity of the synopsis. It lies in the unmitigated arbitrariness of Fromm's manner of presenting his ideas. He writes not like a scientist, but like an oracle who is not obliged to give reasons or proof. It is true that man differs fundamentally from all other living species by virtue of possessing a rational conceptual faculty. It is true that for man, survival is a problem to be solved by the exercise of his intelligence. It is true that no man lives long enough to exhaust his every potentiality. It is true that every man is alone, separate, and unique. It is true that thinking requires independence. These are the facts that grant glory to man's existence. Why would one choose to regard these facts as a terrifying cosmic paradox and to see in them the evidence of monumentally tragic human problems? There are men who resent the fact that their life is their responsibility, and that the task of their reason is to discover how to maintain it. Large numbers of such men, men who prefer the state of animals, may be found, or used to be found, sleeping on the benches of any public park. They are called tramps. There are men who find thought abnormal and unnatural. Large numbers of such men may be found in mental institutions. They are called morons. There are men who suffer a chronic preoccupation with death, who bitterly resent the fact that they cannot simultaneously be a concert pianist, a business tycoon, a railroad engineer, a baseball player, and a deep-sea diver, who find their existence as separate, independent entities an unendurable burden. Large numbers of such men may be found in the offices of psychotherapists. They are called neurotics. But why does Fromm choose tramps, morons, and neurotics as his symbols of humanity, as his image of man? And why does he choose to claim that theirs is the state in which all men are destined to start, and out of which they must struggle to rise? Fromm does not tell us. Nowhere does he establish any logical connection between the facts he observes and the conclusions he announces. If we are not to regard his conclusions as arbitrary, as mystical revelations in effect, then we must assume that he does not bother to give reasons for his position, because he regards his conclusions as virtually self-evident, as irresistibly conveyed by the facts he cites, easily available to everyone's experience and introspection. But if he feels it is readily apparent by introspection that the facts he cites constitute an agonizing problem for man, the most appropriate answer one can give is, "Speak for yourself, brother." Reason, Fromm insists, and the self-awareness which reason makes possible, turns man's separate, disunited existence into an unbearable prison, and man would become insane could he not liberate himself from this prison and reach out, unite himself in some form or other with men, with the world outside. The following paragraph is typical of what Fromm considers an explanation. The experience of separateness arouses anxiety. It is indeed the source of all anxiety. Being separate means being cut off, without any capacity to use my human powers. Hence, to be separate means to be helpless, unable to grasp the world, things, and people actively. It means that the world can invade me without my ability to react. Thus, separateness is the source of intense anxiety. Beyond that, it arouses shame and the feeling of guilt. This experience of guilt and shame and separateness is expressed in the biblical story of Adam and Eve. After Adam and Eve have eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, after they have disobeyed, after they have become human by having emancipated themselves from the original animal harmony with nature, i.e., after their birth as human beings, they saw that they were naked and they were ashamed. Should we assume that a myth as old and elementary as this has the prudish morals of the 19th century outlook? And that the important point the story wants to convey to us is the embarrassment that their genitals were visible? This can hardly be so. And by understanding the story in a Victorian spirit, we miss the main point, which seems to be the following. After man and woman have become aware of themselves and of each other, they are aware of their separateness and of their difference, inasmuch as they belong to different sexes. But while recognizing their separateness, they remain strangers because they have not yet learned to love each other, as is also made very clear by the fact that Adam defends himself by blaming Eve, rather than by trying to defend her. The awareness of human separation without reunion by love is the source of shame. It is at the same time the source of guilt and anxiety. All social institutions, all cultures, all religions and philosophies, all progress, asserts Fromm, are motivated by man's need to escape the terrifying sense of helplessness and aloneness to which his reason condemns him. The necessity to find ever new solutions for the contradictions in his existence, to find ever higher forms of unity with nature, his fellow men and himself, is the source of all psychic forces which motivate man. In Man for Himself, Fromm states that only through reason, productiveness, and love can man solve the problem of his separateness and achieve a new union with the world around him. Fromm's claim to be an advocate of reason is disingenuous, to say the least. He speaks of reason and love as being only two different forms of comprehending the world. As if this were not an unequivocal proof of his mysticism, he goes on to speak, in The Art of Loving, of the paradoxical logic of Eastern religions, which he tells us approvingly is not encumbered by the Aristotelian law of contradiction, and which teaches that man can perceive reality only in contradictions. Hegel and Marx, he asserts correctly, belong to his paradoxical epistemological line. His discussion of what he means by productiveness is scarcely more gratifying. In The Art of Loving, written some years after Man for Himself, he declares that reason and productive work, though certainly important, provide only partial and by themselves very unsatisfactory solutions. The unity they achieve is not interpersonal, and the desire for interpersonal fusion is the most powerful striving in man. Fromm pulls an unexplained switch at this point. What began as a problem between man and nature is now to be solved, in some unspecified manner, by human togetherness. One is not surprised. In reading Fromm, this is the sort of pronouncement for which one is waiting. There is a sense of inevitability about it. Love and love alone, he tells us with wonderful originality, can allay man's terror. Love is the only sane and satisfactory answer to the problem of human existence. Only through relating oneself positively to others, only through feeling care and responsibility for them, while preserving one's personal integrity, he adds somewhat mysteriously, can man establish new ties, a new union, that will release him from alienated aloneness. The cat is now ready to be let fully out of the bag. The preceding is Fromm's view of alienation as a metaphysical problem. Its full meaning and implication become clear when one turns to his social-political analysis of alienation. In the context of the latter, one can see clearly what sort of ties, what sort of union, and what sort of love Fromm has in mind. Every society, as a system of human relationships, may be evaluated by how well it satisfies man's basic psychological needs, says Fromm, i.e., he explains, by the possibilities for love, relatedness, and the experience of personal identity which it offers man. Capitalism, Fromm declares, has been disastrous in this regard. Far from solving the problem of man's alienation, it worsens it immeasurably in many respects. In liberating man from medieval regulation and authority, in breaking the chains of ecclesiastical, economic, and social tyranny, in destroying the stability of the feudal order, capitalism and individualism thrust upon man an unprecedented freedom that was bound to create a deep feeling of insecurity, powerlessness, doubt, aloneness, and anxiety. Scratch a collectivist and you will usually find a medievalist. Fromm is not an exception. Like so many socialists, he is a glamorizer of the Middle Ages. He perfunctorily acknowledges the faults of that historical period, but in contrasting it with the capitalism that succeeded it, he is enchanted by what he regards as its virtues. What characterizes medieval, in contrast to modern society, is its lack of individual freedom. But although a person was not free in the modern sense, neither was he alone or isolated. In having a distinct, unchangeable, and unquestionable place in the social world from the moment of birth, man was rooted in a structuralized whole, and thus life had a meaning which left no place and no need for doubt. A person was identical with his role in society. He was a peasant, an artisan, a knight, and not an individual who happened to have this or that occupation. The social order was conceived as a natural order, and being a definite part of it gave man a feeling of security and of belonging. There was comparatively little competition. One was born into a certain economic position, which guaranteed a livelihood determined by tradition, just as it carried economic obligations to those higher in the social hierarchy. But within the limits of his social sphere, the individual actually had much freedom to express his self in his work and in his emotional life. Although there was no individualism in the modern sense of the unrestricted choice between many possible ways of life, a freedom of choice which is largely abstract, there was a great deal of concrete individualism in real life. It is not uncommon to encounter this sort of perspective on the Middle Ages among writers on alienation. But what makes the above passage especially shocking and offensive in the case of Fromm is that he repeatedly professes to be a lover of freedom and a valuer of human life. The complete lack of control over any aspect of one's existence, The ruthless suppression of intellectual freedom, the paralyzing restrictions on any form of individual initiative and independence, these are cardinal characteristics of the Middle Ages. But all of this is swept aside by Frome, along with the famines, the plagues, the exhausting labor from sunrise to sunset, the suffocating routine, the superstitious terror, the attacks of mass hysteria afflicting entire towns, the nightmare brutality of men's dealings with one another, the use of legalized torture as a normal way of life. All of this is swept aside, so entranced is Frome by the vision of a world in which men did not have to invent and compete, they had only to submit and obey. Nowhere does he tell us what specifically the medieval man's concrete individualism consisted of. One is morbidly curious to know what he would say. With the collapse of medievalism and the emergence of a free market society, Frome declares, man was compelled to assume total responsibility for his own survival. He had to produce and to trade. He had to think and to judge. He had no authority to guide him and nothing but his own ability to keep him in existence. No longer could he, by virtue of the class into which he was born, inherit his sense of personal identity. Henceforward, he had to achieve it. This posed a devastating psychological problem for man, intensifying his basic feeling of isolation and separateness. It is true, Frome remarks, that the capitalistic mode of production is conducive to political freedom, while any centrally planned social order is in danger of leading to political regimentation and eventually to dictatorship. Capitalism, he further concedes, has proven itself superlatively capable of producing goods and of raising men's material standard of living to undreamed of heights. But a sane society must have more to offer man than political freedom and material well-being. Capitalism, Frome insists, is destructive of man's spirit. He offers several reasons for this charge, which are very revealing. 1. Like Marx, Frome decries the humiliating predicament of the worker who has to sell his services. Capitalism condemns the worker to experience himself not as a man, but as a commodity, as a thing to be traded. Furthermore, since he is only a tiny part of a vast production process, since, for example, he does not build an entire automobile himself and then drive home in it, but builds only a small part of it, the total being subsequently sold to some unknown distant party, the worker feels alienated from the product of his own labor, and therefore feels alienated from his own labor as such. Unlike the artisan of the Middle Ages, whose labor could express the full richness of his personality. It is an elementary fact of economics that specialization and exchange, under a division of labor, make a level of productivity possible which otherwise would not be remotely attainable. In pre-capitalist centuries, when a man's economic well-being was limited by the goods he himself could produce with his own primitive tools, an unconscionable amount of labor was required to make or acquire the simplest necessities, and the general standard of living was appallingly low. Human existence was a continual, exhausting struggle against imminent starvation. About half of the children born perished before the age of 10. But with the development of the wages system under capitalism, the introduction of machinery, and the opportunity for a man to sell his labor, life, to say nothing of an ever-increasing standard of material well-being, was made possible for millions who could have had no chance at survival in pre-capitalist economies. However, for Frome and those who share his viewpoint, these considerations are doubtless too materialistic. To offer men a chance to enjoy an unprecedented material well-being is evidently to sentence them to alienation, whereas to hold them down to the stagnant level of a medieval serf or guildsman is to offer them spiritual fulfillment. 2. Frome decries the anonymity of the social forces inherent in the structure of the capitalistic mode of production. The laws of the market, of supply and demand, of economic cause and effect, are ominously impersonal. No single individual's wishes control them. Is it the worker who determines how much he is to be paid? No. It is not even the employer. It is that faceless monster, the market. It determines the wage level in some manner beyond the worker's power to grasp. As for the capitalist, his position is scarcely better. He too is helpless. The individual capitalist expands his enterprise not primarily because he wants to, but because he has to, because postponement of further expansion would mean regression. If he attempts to stagnate, he will go out of business. Under such a system, asks Frome, how can man not feel alienated? Consider what Frome is denouncing. Under capitalism, the wages paid to a man for his work are determined objectively, by the law of supply and demand. The market, reflecting the voluntary judgments of all those who participate in it, all those who buy and sell, produce and consume, offer or seek employment, establishes the general price level of goods and services. This is the context which men are obliged to consider in setting the prices they will ask for their work or offer for the work of others. If a man demands more than the market value of his work, he will remain unemployed. If a particular employer offers him less than the market value of his work, the man will seek and find employment elsewhere. The same principle applies to the capitalist who offers his goods for sale. If the prices and quality of his goods are comparable or preferable to those of other men in the same field of production, he will be able to compete. If others can do better than he can, if they can offer superior goods and or lower prices, he will be obliged to improve, to grow, to equal their achievement, or else he will lose his customers. The standard determining a producer's success or failure is the objective value of his product, as judged within the context of the market, and of their knowledge, by those to whom he offers his product. This is the only rational and just principle of exchange, but this is what Frome considers evil. What he rebels against is objectivity. How, he demands, can a man not feel alienated in a system where his wishes are not omnipotent, where the unearned is not to be had, where growth is rewarded and stagnation is penalized? It is clear from the foregoing that Frome's basic quarrel is with reality. Since nature confronts man with the identical conditions which a free economy merely reflects, nature too holds man to the law of cause and effect. Nature too makes constant growth a condition of successful life. There are writers on alienation who recognize this and do not bother to center their attacks on capitalism. They damn nature outright. They declare that man's life is intrinsically and inescapably tragic, since reality is tyrannical, since contradictory desires cannot be satisfied, since objectivity is a prison, since time is a net that no one can elude, etc. Existentialists in particular specialize in this sort of pronouncement. 3. As consumer in a capitalist economy, Frome contends man is subject to further alienating pressures. He is overwhelmed with innumerable products among which he must choose. He is bewildered and brainwashed by the blandishments of advertisers, forever urging him to buy their wares. This staggering multiplicity of possible choices is threatening to his sanity. Moreover, he is conditioned to consume for the sake of consuming, to long for an ever higher standard of living merely in order to keep the system going. With automatic washing machines, automatic cameras, and automatic can openers, modern man's relationship to nature becomes more and more remote. He is increasingly condemned to the nightmare of an artificial world. No such problem confronted the feudal serf. This much is true. Sleeping on an earthen floor, the medieval serf, to say nothing of the caveman, was much closer to nature, in one uncomfortable and unhygienic sense of the word. The above criticism of capitalism has become very fashionable among social commentators. What is remarkable is that almost invariably, as in the case of Frome, the criticism is made by the same writers who are loudest in crying that man needs more leisure. Yet the purpose of the gadgets they condemn is specifically to liberate man's time. Thus they wish to provide man with more leisure, while damning the material means that make leisure possible. As for the charge, equally popular, that the multiplicity of choices offered to man in capitalistic society is threatening to his mental equilibrium, it should be remembered that fear of choices and decisions is a basic symptom of mental illness. To whose mentality, then, do these critics of capitalism demand that society be adjusted? 4. The development of a complex, highly industrialized society requires an extreme degree of quantification and abstraction in man's method of thinking, observes Fromm. And this, in still another way, estranges man from the world around him. He loses the ability to relate to things in their concreteness and uniqueness. One can agree with Fromm in part. An industrial technological society demands the fullest development and exercise of man's conceptual faculty, i.e. of his instinctively human form of cognition. The sensory perceptual level of consciousness, the level of an animal's cognition, will not do. Those who assert that the conceptual level of consciousness alienates men from the real world merely confess that their concepts bear no relation to reality, or that they do not understand the relation of concepts to reality. But it should be remembered that the capacity to abstract and conceptualize offers man, to the extent that he is rational, a means of relating to the world around him immeasurably superior to that enjoyed by any other species. It does not alienate man from nature. It makes him nature's master. An animal obeys nature blindly. Man obeys her intelligently, and thereby acquires the power to command her. 5. Finally, most alienating of all, perhaps, are the sort of relationships that exist among men under capitalism, says Fromm. What is the modern man's relationship to his fellow man? It is one between two abstractions, two living machines who use each other. The employer uses the ones whom he employs, the salesman uses his customers. There is not much love or hate to be found in human relations of our day. There is rather a superficial friendliness and a more than superficial fairness, but behind that surface is distance and indifference. This book is continued on Disc 11.